This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, an artist helps us explore our familiar environments to find emotional and artistic inspiration. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled at the end of last month that a Colorado-based website designer could deny her services to same-sex couples seeking a wedding website. The designer said her religious beliefs opposed same-sex marriage. The court's majority ruled that her work is a form of free speech and that Colorado anti-discrimination laws can't force her into speech that would, quote, defy her conscience about a matter of major significance. The majority opinion in the case said that the same protections would apply to other businesses that provide a service involving a form of speech or expression. Opponents say that the ruling will embolden other businesses to discriminate against LGBT community members and claim free speech protections. The case has raised big questions about who and what the First Amendment protects and where the line is between free speech and discrimination. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following this Supreme Court case? What do you make of the ruling? Do you think they got it right? What questions do you have about this case, the First Amendment, discrimination laws? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Craig Conneth is the Martha Lubin Karsh and Bruce A. Karsh Bicentennial Professor of Law at the University of Virginia, where he studies health law, constitutional law, and LGBT rights. He was formerly the Deputy Solicitor General for the state of California. Craig, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me here, Rob.
Now, I gave a very short summary of this case, cases that go to the Supreme Court. There's a lot of tangles and loops leading along the way. Can you give us some of the background of what brought this to the nation's highest court?
Yeah, absolutely. So basically, a few years ago, a graphic designer, Laurie Smith, who built websites but did not build wedding websites, said that she wanted to build wedding websites, but she also wanted to post a notice saying that she would not make wedding websites for same-sex couples. She filed a case in district court. The district court said, well, you've got to actually have a case for it. Someone has to come to you, say that they want a wedding website. You have to be prosecuted in some way. There has to be a case where you are somehow being targeted for not serving same-sex couples. So you basically lose on what lawyers call standing. You have no standing to bring the case until you actually suffer some kind of burden. In the Tenth Circuit, the Court of Appeals held, well, actually, she does have standing. She can bring the case because there's a good chance she will be prosecuted because the law prevents her from posting that she won't serve same-sex couples, but that she loses on the merits, that actually the law can require her to serve same-sex couples for their wedding websites on an equal basis as different-sex couples. And then finally, she asked the Supreme Court to review the case, and the Supreme Court basically held, as you said, that she had a First Amendment right to violate the Colorado anti-discrimination law in question here.
What kind of precedent do you think this case sets now for, I mean, this one was specific to a website designer who's going to do wedding websites. What other things could this ruling open the door to?
So there are two possible ways this case may go, right? So one way in which some commentators have treated this case is that it's very narrow. What the Colorado Attorney General did in the lower courts is that they agreed that building a website is expressive speech, basically. And so right in the first couple of pages of the opinion, Justice Gorsuch, who's writing for the court, says the parties agreed that this is protected speech. And so therefore, our ruling rests on that fact. In other cases, the parties may not agree that the speech is actually protected. So there was a prior case involving a baker, as you may recall, and the baker said baking a cake is a form of expression and should be protected. So you can sort of see people disputing what exactly is protected speech or not. If the ruling is narrow, then we may only see this play a role when it comes to sort of building a website, or printing wedding invitations, or maybe photography, but, you know, potentially not much further. people like me who are maybe a little more pessimistic as you look at the way the Supreme Court's behaved over the last few years, think that this is going to sweep more broadly, that you are going to have florists and bakers and others also say, well, this is expression, and lower courts agreeing with them. But that has to do with what people are doing, making cakes, etc. The second question is, whom will they be able to discriminate against? So here we're talking about same-sex couples, same-sex weddings. But really, there's nothing in the opinion that prevents someone from coming in tomorrow and saying, well, I object to interracial weddings. And while I have nothing against black people, I object to them marrying white people. And so I will not make a wedding website for interracial weddings. So this has the potential to sweep quite broadly. Even beyond discrimination, this has the potential to, you know, so someone believes that they have to, you know, to build a website in complying with various other laws or regulations, or you've got to, you know, prepare documents that comply with, you know, reports that are set by safety agencies that the state says, and an organization comes in and says, well, actually, this violates our First Amendment rights. And it's quite unclear what courts will do, because if this is expressive speech, then the limit is very, very porous.
Now, we've looked at the majority opinion here saying, in effect, hey, we think this Colorado law would be compelling this person to make speech that they creative expression that they don't agree with. The dissent here made the case that the three justices who voted against this ruling said you're legalizing discrimination against certain people who are doing something legal, getting married. Can you talk a little more about what we heard from the three justices who dissented from the opinion?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that there were, you know, various elements to this, but I think the key point for me that I took away was the dissent saying, look, our previous precedent. So there is an important precedent here where you have law schools, you know, back in when the military discriminated against people. A law school said, we don't want the military recruiting on our campuses because that basically forces us into, you know, circulating emails on behalf of the military who are recruiting, and we are basically then engaging in speech that we don't want to engage in on behalf of an anti-gay organization, that is the U.S. military at that point. And the Supreme Court said, well, it's not your speech, it's the U.S. military speech. And so similarly, the dissent relied on that and said, look, in this case, Laurie Smith is not speaking on behalf of herself. She's speaking on behalf of the couple that's getting married. And you can see this analogy in other contexts, right? So the spokesperson for the White House isn't speaking on behalf of him or herself. He or she is speaking on behalf of the White House. So similarly here, it is not the speech of the designer, and therefore she does not get to claim First Amendment protections. I think more broadly, though, it's generally been accepted that these kinds of public accommodation laws serve important government interests. And so even if they incidentally burden the speech of certain groups or certain organizations, the importance of people being able to go into stores, go into hospitals, go into institutions where they can feel safe and get served, that's generally been acknowledged to be an important enough interest that that the incidental burdens of speech have been accepted. And the Supreme Court is undoing that framework.
Talking to Craig Conneth with the law school at the University of Virginia, looking at this U.S. Supreme Court ruling saying a web designer could start a business selling wedding websites, creating wedding websites, and could say, hey, yeah, only opposite-sex couples, only men and women, no same-sex couples. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your reactions. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Randy is with us in Madison. Randy, hi.
Good afternoon. Obviously, this is the wedding cake case redo, and before a radically different Supreme Court. What has really disturbed me, though, is learning that apparently they completely fabricated any defendants in the case. In other words, nobody had approached the plaintiff to ask for a wedding page, or if they had, it was fraudulent. But either way, it's entirely possible, maybe probable, that the plaintiff swore to this under oath.
Randy, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call, Randy. Craig, Randy referred to, I think the original reporting was from the New Republic, who tracked down in an earlier part of this case, the plaintiff had said, hey, I received via my web thing a request from a same-sex couple. The New Republic tracked it down with identifying information. Doesn't appear that that happened. That part was discarded from the case along the way. A lot of people made a lot of it. How big a deal is that?
You know, to be honest, it's not really that big a deal from a legal perspective. I mean, I think that from a political and political perspective, and just, you know, trying to get a sense of how these cases are manufactured and what anti-LGBT rights advocates are doing, I think it's important to see what methods are being deployed. But from the legal perspective here, it doesn't make much of a difference because the courts basically said, you know, look, she wants to post this notice that she won't serve same-sex couples. And her desire to post the notice is they portrayed it, and I believe is independent of whether she was, you know, she was asked to make a website for the same-sex couples. So from a legal perspective, it doesn't play that much of a role.
Thanks for the call, Randy. But how about you touched on this earlier, Craig? The standing ruling. Some observers said, "Hey, wait a minute, you know, she should have started the wedding website." You mentioned this earlier. Been challenged, been targeted under this law. Then there's a case here. There is still some argument out there, I think, about standing. Is that right?
Yeah, to my mind, there is, because she has to show that there is some kind of clear danger that the law will be enforced against her. And there really, you know, there really wasn't. I mean, the Supreme Court said, well, the Colorado Attorney General hasn't disavowed. They haven't said that they will not prosecute her. I think it's very strange to ask and, you know, ask a public entity to do that. But if you look at the Supreme Court's past cases, I mean, you have people who've been stopped and frisked by the police, you know, a hundred times or more within a couple of months, and the Supreme Court has said, "Oh, you don't have standing to come sue the police for prospective, stops and frisks." But in this case, you have someone, who wants to post something that is true, but it really does seem that that this stretches standing doctrine, beyond anything that we've seen before.
Thanks again for that call, Randy. We're talking to University of Virginia Law Professor Craig Conneth about the recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling that allowed a website designer to deny services to same-sex couples seeking wedding websites because of her religious beliefs. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of that decision? The right call, the wrong call? What other creative type jobs do you think should be covered under this ruling, should be able to deny services to someone based on beliefs? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Craig Conneth, law professor and LGBT rights expert from the University of Virginia. And we're looking at a ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court that allowed a Colorado website designer to say she would deny services to same-sex couples seeking a wedding website, citing religious objections. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions to that ruling, your questions about it. Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm disturbed by this decision also. Number one, as I remember, New York state law, I just moved from there recently. Their actual marriage law for gay couples was a civil union law. In other words, they provided, you know, mercy issues, covered mercy issues like visiting in the hospital and contact, you know, institutional issues. For the Catholic Church, marriage is a sacrament. So I think you really have to kind of maybe dig deeper into any state differences between civil union versus marriage.
Okay, I gotcha. And Craig, so before that big Supreme Court ruling legalized same-sex marriage nationwide, this was a debate in a lot of states, you know, full marriage equality, civil unions as an alternative for same-sex couples. I believe that whole civil union thing is just, under the latest from the Supreme Court, is not a part of the story anymore. Do I have that right?
Yeah, it's really not part of the story anymore, because after 2015, marriage equality was mandated across the nation. So that really doesn't sort of become part of the conversation today.
Okay, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Dan in Madison. Dan, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up?
I just wanted to say that I think things have to be kept in perspective, that this is not a person who is trying to run a small business, because I know this for a fact, because to have these types of lawsuits costs many, many hundreds, if not millions of dollars. So somebody who's trying to start a business running a website, it's not funding this, number one. And number two, any rational business person that's trying to start a business would never turn away any type of couple who's going to pay for you to do a website, especially when you're starting out. So this is just part of the cultural wars and the war on gay people, which is really kind of a sad state of affairs. That's really all I had to say.
Dan, thanks a lot for the call. And Craig, there were groups, national groups involved in this that as Dan was suggesting, kind of viewed this as a test case that they were out looking for.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is clearly a case that was sought out. One of the issues in the cake case that went up to the Supreme Court that one of the previous callers and I alluded to earlier was whether baking a cake really constituted expression. And during the oral argument in that case, Justice Kagan raised that question. She said, you know, what becomes speech next? I mean, does a fancy restaurant menu that's made by a Michelin star chef, does that become speech? What about a makeup artist? As she said at oral argument, artist isn't the name of makeup artist. So does that become speech? So I think that, you know, many of the folks who wanted to target these anti-discrimination laws and who wanted to target equality for same-sex couples, they sort of went around looking for cases that would be better. Now, some people have accused the lawyers here of manufacturing the case. Some people have suggested that they manufactured the request that turned out to be fake that was sent to Lori Smith, the website designer in this case. And then, as you said, the New Republic found out that the request was fake. There's no evidence that they manufactured it, but basically, I think that this case was the sort of ideal case for them. And then, of course, the fact got stipulated that this is expressive speech, that made it even better. But beyond that, I think that this becomes the wedge in the door, right? Because you've got a website designer. The next time you'll have a photographer, right? And then you can just sort of keep going, you know, a floral designer, you know, and you can just keep going, thinking about you know, more and more attenuated ways to express yourself and opening the doors, you know, wider and wider to discrimination.
Dan, thanks for that call. Keith joins us now in Spring Green. Keith, hi.
Yes, thank you. It's my understanding that personal bias would be discrimination, that religious belief would be free speech. I'm wondering if the legal system and the court, if they have any sort of questions or filter to decide whether somebody really has that religious belief or whether they just take the person's word.
Interesting, Keith. Thanks for the call. Craig, is there a way that the court was trying to split that hair between bias versus genuine religious belief?
Not at all. I mean, I think that that's a really interesting question, because I think that, you know, you kind of see the court in various other cases trying to figure out, when it comes to other groups, you know, was this person really discriminated against because, you know, they're black or because, you know, they're gay, et cetera. But here, and especially in the cake shop case, the court's really open to claims that someone's being discriminated against because of their religion. Now, I want to make it clear that this case is a free speech case, mm-hmm. right? But in all of these cases, when they're filed in the district court, there's always this religion element. There's always a free exercise element that the anti-discrimination law is harming them because of their religion, right? And the court's precedent hasn't quite gone far enough to say that you can simply ignore the law because of your religious beliefs, at least when it comes to a state law. So I think that. You do have some religion playing a role, but not explicitly. I just want to take a quick step back, though. So basically, there's a federal statute called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act that basically says that when it comes to federal statutes, people have a religious right to disregard certain federal statutes if their religion prohibits them from doing so. And the court's been really sympathetic to those claims. So just recently, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals held that the Title VII, which is the federal anti-discrimination law, has to give way to people's religious beliefs. People can say, I have a religious belief and I can discriminate against whoever I want because of my religious belief. So federal law is already under attack in that way. And I think it's just a matter of time before people sort of turn to state laws and say, well, actually, the Constitution, my free exercise of religion rights under the Constitution allow me to do what I want. And then finally, one last thought is that the court basically takes people at their word, right? So some of you may remember the Hobby Lobby case, which basically prohibited the Obama administration from requiring employers to distribute contraceptives. The employer in that case came in and said, you know, look, we have a religious objection to distributing contraceptives. It violates our religion. And the Supreme Court said, okay, you don't have to. What's interesting is that that same employer used to distribute contraceptives before Obamacare was law. The insurance programs that they signed up to, they distributed contraceptives. Suddenly they decided that it was against their religion, and the Supreme Court did not question that. So yeah, the Supreme Court really allows pretty much free rein when it comes to religious claims. To some degree, I think that's fair, but sometimes it can be quite problematic.
Keith, thanks for that call. And Craig, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
That's Craig Conniff, the Martha Lubin Karsh and Bruce A. Karsh Bicentennial Professor of Law at the University of Virginia, where he studies health law, constitutional law, and LGBT rights. He was with us today to discuss a ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court. This came out late last month. It allowed a business owner to deny services to same-sex couples over religious views and free speech rights. A lot of big U.S. Supreme Court rulings coming out over that last stretch of their term. Check out the archives at WPR.org for a lot of up-close looks at what went into them, what came out of them, what they mean, and there's still more to come. We're kind of playing catch-up. A lot came out over that last couple of weeks. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, climate change plus an El Nino weather pattern adds up to dangerously high temperatures in many parts of the country, many parts of the world. Check out the impact of this year's El Nino and what could be to come for the rest of the summer. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, find out how to encounter the unexpected in familiar places. Go for a walk with some psychogeography. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Producer Mary Kate McCoy brings us a story about an app that helps users practice the Hmong language.
In the late 2000s, Apple popularized the phrase, "There's an app for that," highlighting the abundance of apps available for the iPhone. But when Annie Vang of Madison got into app development around the same time, she didn't see programs made in the Hmong language. Producer Hope Kerwin has more on the app she built and the way it's keeping native speakers and beginners connected to the language.
Eau Claire resident Tiffany Moa grew up speaking Hmong with her family, but as she got older, she started to lose some of her vocabulary and found herself struggling to remember words she didn't use frequently.
You know, you go to school, you speak English only. I didn't have any classes where they taught you in Hmong, so my Hmong language wasn't utilized as much as I had wanted to.
Moa was scrolling through Facebook one day when she saw a post about an iPhone app called Hmong Phrases. The app allows users to look up words and common phrases and hear an audio recording of how they're pronounced. Moa says she immediately downloaded it, hoping to test out her memory and her grammar.
When you grow up and you don't really speak fluent Hmong, you kind of create your own little sentences and you just formulate your own way of saying things, and it's not always correct. One that I do remember looking for was, "Can I pay for this?" Even now, like if I were to go shopping at like an Oriental store, I wouldn't know how to formulate this sentence properly.
The Hmong Phrases app was created by fellow Wisconsinite Annie Vang, who it turns out is also Moa's aunt. Vang is an iOS app developer from Madison, and she built the program 11 years ago after taking an app development course at Madison Area Technical College. Vang says she was inspired by advice from her professor, who encouraged her to build something she was passionate about.
Google Translate didn't exist at that time. And the Hmong language definitely was not in Rosetta Stone or any of the other language apps that were out there in the App Store. And so I took it upon myself that, you know, I want people to know who we are, who I am. And I felt that it was important to just, you know, have a presence in the App Store and leave a digital footprint of it.
11 years, constant updates, and one major rewrite later, the app now has over 4,000 downloads. Vang says she's always looking for ways to improve the program, taking feedback directly from users and from her parents, who are her primary beta testers. She says there have been some surprising requests from users about what they'd like to see added. She's been asked for more medical terms and Hmong names from people hoping to use them for babies.
They're interested in, like, how do you say a baby name? What does it mean? How do you pronounce it? And I thought it was kind of cool. So that's a feature that I'm currently building it right now, because we're such an oral language that if you just read the word, the name, you may not know how to pronounce it.
Beyond learning words and phrases, Vang says the app also allows native Hmong speakers to practice their intonation, an important part of the mostly oral language. She says young Hmong Americans often speak Hmong stiffly or struggle to hit the right tonal marks.
I can hear that a lot in, like, the kids that are growing up there are not speaking it, like, fluently with me being an elder. Even my nieces and nephews do the same thing, where when they say they're hungry, they're saying it, like, it doesn't have the right tone markers. And so you can understand what they're saying, but they may not know that they're saying it more English than Hmong.
This is something that niece and app user Moa says she appreciates about the program. Growing up, Moa says she spoke both English and Hmong to her parents, or sometimes a combination of the two, which she and other speakers call Hmonglish.
My parents knew enough of what I was trying to say that in the spot, because they understood it, they didn't say, oh no, you're saying that wrong. They'll just answer you.
Moa says she's not sure she'll ever fully master the Hmong language, but she's motivated to keep practicing so she can one day pass it on to her children and maintain the connection to her native language.
WPR's Hope Kerwin brought us that story about an app for the Hmong language. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
This is Central Time. Now, how well do you know your local landscape, your neighborhood, your community, your local park? For a lot of us, we really only experience a small portion of the place we live, on the paths we travel the most, the roads to and from work, the store, and so on. But we can get something more out of that local landscape with a change of our mindset. That's one goal of something called psychogeography. It's a fancy word. It means in practice walking and exploring in a way that's intentionally unintentional. Our next guest is a Wisconsin artist who uses psychogeography as an inspiration for his art, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite place to go for a regular walk? When you walk, do you have to have a destination in mind, or do you just start wandering? And do you find ways to connect, to observe the places you walk around? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Jeremy Weinberg is a designer, educator, and visual artist based in Madison. Jeremy, welcome to the studio.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, tell us more about this concept of psychogeography. What is it?
I kind of think of it like the practice of mapping your thoughts out onto the environment, and then at the same time having the environment mapped onto your thoughts. So it's sort of a two-way street where you're bringing what you have going on internally to bear on the environment, but you're also allowing the environment to directly impact what's going on internally.
And what's some of the history of this idea?
Well, I think the term comes from the Situationist International and a particular person named Guy Debord. But the practice of it and the techniques that it uses have been going on for a long time before that. I think for the Situationist International, it was a way of subverting things like the way that the city was planned out for you to get from point A to point B, and wandering or allowing yourself to drift was a way of getting around how people want you to move through the city. So it was almost like a form of protest for them. But earlier, I think and this is the part that I felt the most drawn to, was the surrealists, who really saw the city as this place of mystery that you dive into and explore and unravel and come up with interesting ways to make work, to make connections that you wouldn't have necessarily made before, to meet interesting people, and to get a level of detail from your surroundings that you don't normally get when you're just kind of stumbling around on your way to work or to the market or what have you.
In just a bit, I want to talk about how this inspires your art. But for people at home who are thinking, okay, this sounds kind of cool, I want to give it a try. You mentioned there are kind of methods, not rules exactly, but psychogeography methods that we can use. If somebody wants to go for that walk, maybe in their own neighborhood, their community, how can they get started on this?
Well, it's really about sort of leading with your nose, paying attention to what is in front of you and allowing things that you're seeing to act as clues, to cultivate a sense of curiosity, to create a direction or a movement. There's actually this really great quote that I've used when I've taught projects that deal with it from an artist named Robert McFarlane. I can read it because
sure.
He just says it so wonderfully that I don't know that I can
go for it. Yeah,
really do too much more in explaining it. But he begins by saying, psychogeography, a beginner's guide. Unfold a street map of London. Place a glass rim down anywhere on the map and draw around its edge. Pick up the map. Go out into the city and walk the circle, keeping as close as you can to the curve. Record the experience as you go in whatever medium you favor: film, photograph, transcript, manuscript, tape. Catch the textural runoff of the streets, the graffiti, the branded litter, the snatches of conversation. Cut for sign. Log the data stream. Be alert to happenstances of metaphors. Watch for visual rhymes, coincidences, analogies, family resemblances, the changing moods of the street. Complete the circle, and the record ends. Walking makes for content, footage for footage.
Now, I think I'm better at getting into that kind of mindset and doing that kind of random walk when I go to a new place. I'm really bad at it close to home, which seems like possibly like a place that would be really ripe for that kind of cool, innovative discovery.
Yeah, I think it works in either way. For me, it's a way to explore a new area and dive deep into it and become familiar with it. But it's also a way to explore familiar areas and to make them new again, to see them differently. And there's all sorts of techniques that people have come up with to sort of do this on familiar territory. One of the surrealist techniques that I think is great is take a map of another city and use it to navigate the city that you're in. So it's a way of sort of making you go or move through something that you're used to moving through in a very different way, and using that as a way to create the stimulus that you don't normally get when you move through that environment. So it's maybe a little different tact when you're familiar with it, because you have to do something to make it different and to be able to sort of separate you from the the everyday mindset that you're used to moving it through to get into, to be able to see it differently.
We're talking with Wisconsin-based artist and educator Jeremy Weinberg about the creative and emotional benefits of wandering and exploring our familiar environments. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you do this, these kind of random walks, looking at things in a new way, maybe in your own community, or in the early days of COVID, when there wasn't a lot better to do than go for a walk? Did you find new and interesting ways, turning a different way on that street? You turn left instead of right like you usually would. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Jeremy Weinberg, a Wisconsin-based artist and educator, about the idea of psychogeography, walking and exploring our environments by following our minds, not our schedules, finding different ways to look at familiar territory, getting inspiration by doing so. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you're an artist, have you found inspiration just by walking around? Have you trained yourself in some ways to seek out some artistic inspiration from a familiar environment? If you like to go for a lot of walks, do you shake things up, break through routine, find random ways to appreciate that local walk? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jeremy, a lot of your art is inspired by this psychogeographical mindset. Can you give us a couple examples of what's come out of that?
Sure. The last piece, I think, that that I spent a lot of time in that sort of state of mind at had to do with Lake Winnebago. And my mother-in-law has a house on Lake Winnebago, so we spend a lot of time there and have been going there repeatedly over the last, since I've been in Wisconsin, so like the last 15 years. And I wanted to make a piece that dealt with this particular place, but I wanted to bring in some other viewpoints. So I asked people that went to school there, that lived there, for some video documents or photo documents that they might have taken of the place that have stood out to them. And then I sort of threw those together with some of my own video documents that I'd taken over the years and created this video installation where a lot of these points of view were kind of mixed up and projected in a space that was at the University of Oshkosh, which is in University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh, sure, at the Alan Preeb Gallery. And that was last fall. So the thing I think that that really made it interesting to me was that all of the projections that were happening in the room were bounced around by a lot of reflective material that was also hanging in the room. So it's sort of hard to describe, but essentially you're walking into a space that's located nearby the lake shore, and you're having images of the lake sort of bouncing all around you. So for people that live on the lake or by the lake or have to deal with things that are particular to Lake Winnebago, like the lake flies and things like that, it was a different way to experience it from how they're used to doing. So my hope was that, you know, people would be able to sort of come out of it seeing things a little differently than they're used to. So that's one of them. I have a few other projects too that about other places that I've been interested in, but a lot of them are relatively local.
And do you have kind of eureka moments? You're out there, you're walking, you're trying to do this sort of psychogeography type observation. How do things like sort of gradually build up, or do you have aha moments where you're like, aha, I could do this inspired by this part of the environment?
I think really for me, what I have are the like a thousand little aesthetic moments that I do the best I can to document. either by taking a video or a photo or by doing a drawing or just like trying to make a memory that stays around long enough that I can, you know, somehow work it in. But for me, it's an aesthetic experience that usually is what draws my attention. You know, one of the things I remember particularly after moving here and doing walks like this that I wasn't prepared for was stumbling across some of the Native American effigy mounds and not knowing anything about that because I grew up in another part of the country. So to me, that was just mind-blowing that there are these things that I stumbled across that, you know, were from thousands of years ago that cultures that had nothing to do with the city built, and here they are in this particular neighborhood.
Even if we're not going to make art based on our observations, I've seen people make a case for the benefits, our emotional well-being, our connection to our surroundings. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of the things that allows you to do is just like read a level of complexity into a place. Almost like the kind of complexity that you might like read into another person that you meet. You get a sense of a particular mood of a place, and you can sort of have a conversation with it by just looking at the way, you know, the plants are growing around each other, looking at how, like, you know, there may be paths that have been worn into a particular park where people go off of the walkways and make their own walkways and what happens there and following those and seeing where they go instead, or finding traces of animals or people's dogs or discarded clothing that might have been left somewhere that, you know, there's got to be some kind of story behind. So for me, like, this is all like it's just a deeper experience of a place. And for places that you're visiting regularly, I feel like it's like getting to know an elder or somebody that you know, has been around for a long time, and realizing that there's this a depth to their experiences and that you can learn a lot from them.
Yeah, and the time element, the Lake Winnebago thing you mentioned, getting older pictures and images from there, and just the idea of going to the same place again and again and seeing how it can change, maybe just through the seasons, adds a lot of depth.
Yeah, and so like one place that I feel like I like to haunt is in Madison. It's a park in the Vilas neighborhood, Bear Mound Park. Which is the first place that I stumbled on an effigy mound. But there's also these beautiful old oak trees there. And going there different times of years, you see different things. There's not only the leaves changing, but I've seen, you know, all of these milkweed pods, like, open up and create these, like, flows of all this white, fluffy material that just, when you sort of put yourself in like an insect point of view, moving through all of that, it's like being in a whole nother world, but it's just this little, you know, one block circle. But inside of that circle, there's just this whole microcosm of not only like all these natural things, but this like level of cultural history that goes back like thousands of years. To me, it's just a fascinating place.
And just our last half a minute or so, leave us with some inspiration for somebody who says, yeah, I want to try this. One quick thing they might do after they turn off the radio.
So I think just going out and spinning yourself around and opening your eyes up and following that first thing that you see is a good way to start. You know, if you have the opportunity to go someplace new, I feel like it's a little bit easier because everything is kind of something to jump into. But there's always new things around you if you just try to shift your perspective a little bit and see it from a different angle.
Jeremy, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for coming up to the studio.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
That's Jeremy Weinberg, designer, educator, and visual artist based in Madison. He joined us to talk about the art of psychogeography, finding inspiration by wandering and exploring around the places we live and beyond. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, there's new competition from an old social media company with Facebook's parent company opening up Threads, a new competitor to Twitter. Find out what it all means for your social media experience. Plus, check out the commercial history of ICE in the United States. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, it's a great time for a motorcycle ride, an even better time for everyone on the road to think about motorcycle safety. Get advice for motorcyclists and for all drivers. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.